Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Jean Bishop. Jean is an assistant public defender in the Cook County courts, but is the author of a book called Change of Heart. It talks about the journey that she has gone through over many years, from the night when her sister and brother-in-law were murdered. A terrible event, tragedy, but it is, together with her own background, has caused her to take a long journey towards restorative justice, which is one of the topics we're going to be talking about today. Jean Bishop, With Respect. Jean, how are you today?
Very well, John. Thanks.
Good, good. All right, who are you? Where are you from? Where are you from originally?
I was born in Winnetka, Illinois, which is this very small, safe, affluent suburb on the North Shore of Chicago.
All right, now I've got to ask this question. This question is very important to me. Were you raised a Cubs fan or a White Sox fan?
Cubs.
No, that's too bad. Yeah. That's really sad.
Sorry.
Tomorrow, my brother and I are going to, with my daughter and her husband to a White Sox game, the only good team. Right? Okay. Well, anyway, I just want to get that out on the table. Seriously, so what interested you when you were a kid? What are the things that really got you interested in life?
What a great question. I grew up in a very musical household. My mother had been a music and theater major at University of Illinois, where she met my dad. And my dad had been an athlete in college. He was on the tennis team and won the Big Ten doubles championship.
At the University of Illinois.
Yeah, they met there in Champaign. And so the things that interested me, I think, were the things that interested my parents, because we were exposed to it early. So there was always singing around the piano in my house, always, you know, being in the school musical, you know, playing tennis with my dad, things like that.
What is the song? Daddy sings bass, Mama sings tenor. Johnny Cash. So, what about your family? What you have brothers, sisters?
Two sisters. I'm the middle. My older sister, Jennifer, is a few years older than me. And my younger sister, Nancy, is the one who was murdered. She was 5 years younger.
So, what did your other two sisters do when they were growing up? Are they also musical people, or did have other skills that they got involved, things that they got interested in?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, one of the things I write about in my book is that when Nancy was in high school at New Trier High School, which is one of the most, you know, well-known, you know, schools for the arts in the country, it turned out people like Charlton Heston and Anne Margaret, you know, she got the lead in the musical West Side Story. She played the part of Maria. And she was a very talented singer and actress.
How about your older sister?
She did musical, too. She's a great pianist, guitar player, singer. She and I, you know, were in Fiddler on the Roof together in high school.
What part did you play?
I was Seidel, and she played my mom.
Ah! Now, that must have been hard for her to say, I've got a daughter already? So, what about your parents as they went through? Did they obviously they were athletes? Your dad was an athlete. Were you an athlete too?
I was. I was on the varsity tennis team in my high school, and we won the state championship in our division 1 year. I played soccer, field hockey. He came to all my games.
That's good. That's excellent. What about your mom? Did she continue with musical productions afterwards?
She did. One of my happiest memories growing up is going to see her in these professional productions and to see this mom that, you know, made our lunches in the morning and, you know, made sure our socks matched, you know, up on stage in some, you know, glamorous gown dancing.
Mm-hmm. Was and lovely. On her own. And doing it not as a part of a family, but rather as an individual.
Yeah, and to see the way my father supported her was really lovely. He was so proud of her.
Mm-hmm. Are they still alive?
Unfortunately, my father passed away 11 years ago, right mm-hmm. after my youngest child was born. He died a few days later. My mother still is living. She lives four blocks away from me.
Okay. You're living now in Winnetka, or
I am. Yeah, the very town where I was born. We moved to Dallas and then Oklahoma City. I used to live out in New England for a while, and I've come back. A few blocks from where I was born.
There is so many families in which that happens. That kids say, "I am getting out of here. I can't stand this place. It's too small. It's too big. It's too crowded. It's too," and they come home.
Yes.
I know. Oh, well, all right. So, yourself, what about schooling? You went to New Trier High School.
Actually, I didn't. I was in Oklahoma City at the time.
Okay.
We moved right after I graduated from the school I attended there. But Nancy went to New Trier all mm-hmm. 4 years. After high school, I went to the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University.
My brother went there.
Oh.
Yeah, he got his master's there before he went over to Vietnam. Go ahead.
Oh, wow. And then after that, I started law school at Northwestern, and I finished at Yale in my third year. I did a year there because I had moved out to New England by then.
Why law, for pity's sakes? I mean, you know, music is not law. Come on. I like to say I have a great singing voice, which my daughter contests, but...
No, my dad was a lawyer, and my grandfather on my mother's side and my uncle were lawyers, so that was kind of in the family. My grandfather was the four-term Republican state's attorney of Champaign County, Illinois.
Ah, so that's our family had this same DNA failing also. We had a bunch of lawyers in our family and a couple of one judge way back, but mostly we're just in private practice, or my brother in government service, or me in government service for a while, and so into private practice. But it's catching. I mean, you can't get away from it. I tried.
Yeah. I mean, I really thought I was going to be a reporter. But when I was in college and on this Human Relations Commission in the city of Evanston, you know, which was tasked with enforcing the Fair Housing Ordinance, anti-discrimination mm-hmm. ordinance, you know, I saw that where change really happened was in court.
Why? So that was the thing that moved you over, is that the possibility of making changes?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know why.
What's inside of you to want to change things?
You know, it's really interesting. My parents raised us, and my dad in particular, raised us to have a sense not only of, you know, ourselves and our own little, you know, concerns, but that we're part of a larger community. We were always part of a larger faith community, being raised, you know, in church. He was very involved in, you know, civic organizations. There was this idea instilled in us that, you know, actually was preached at my baccalaureate at high school, that to whom much is given, much is required.
Mm-hmm. And did he, besides being a lawyer, have any specific things that he did along those lines?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he served as an elder in the Presbyterian Church. He taught the confirmation class for many years. This is the seventh and eighth graders mm-hmm. that are learning about their faith. He you know, served in all sorts of, you know, government business associations, you know, as a mm-hmm. as a lawyer and businessman.
Now, how about you? You became a lawyer, but did you start right off in being a public defender?
No, I didn't. Somewhere along the way in law school, I kind of lost track of, you know, why I went there in the first place. So you kind of, you know, at least at the time, I got kind of sucked into this idea of success, which is, you know, make the best grades, get on law review, go work for the big law firm, make the big paycheck. You know, so I was really, you know, started out my career in the law thinking, you know, money, prestige, and found almost immediately that I was terrible at corporate law because I didn't care deeply about it. It wasn't deeply meaningful to me, and that I was really, you know, falling short of what I owed I think, to the law firms that were good enough to hire me. I was not giving my best, truest self to what I did.
I've heard people in large law firms who decide to leave say they got tired of helping rich people keep their money.
And I left, you know, not for that reason. I left because when Nancy died at age 25, my younger sister and I'd already lived a few years longer than she had at that point. It was the starkest wake-up call imaginable, that life is short.
Now, did this horrible event, which we're going to be talking about in some detail, did that occur while you were still in this large law firm?
Yes.
Oh, so I can see the transformative event coming here. So when you, did you work in the large law firm in Chicago or elsewhere?
Started out in New England and then came to Chicago. I worked for this firm called Mayer Brown.
Mm-hmm. I know the firm. It's well known. A number of my friends are there, I think. So my question now is, let's focus on the event, which is the heart of your book. It's all about your book and has obviously affected your whole life.
Yes.
And that is your sister's death. And tell us about that.
Yes. You know, we were this very happy family of, you know, three girls, my two parents, and we were going out one night to celebrate my father's birthday and Nancy's pregnancy. Even though she was the youngest of these us three girls, she was the first to get pregnant, the first who would have become a mom. So that would have been my parents' first grandchild and my first little niece or nephew. So mm-hmm. everyone was just over the moon with happiness. And we gathered at this restaurant on Clark Street on the night before Palm Sunday, April 7th, 1990. And we all, you know, hugged goodbye in the parking lot afterwards. And I went home to my apartment on Chestnut Street in Chicago. My parents went to their big home, you know, when Nancy and Richard went home to their townhouse, and the killer was waiting for them there.
What about your other sister? Was she at the dinner?
She wasn't. I can't remember why. She was living further away then, and, mm-hmm. and so wasn't able to get together with us as much at that point
okay.
in her life.
So where was your sister and her husband living at the time?
They were living in a townhouse on Oak Street in Winnetka, right near the train tracks. My parents owned this townhouse, and they were planning to move into it when they downsized from their big home mm-hmm. in Winnetka.
Tell me about your brother-in-law. What was he like?
He was the most wonderful guy. He was nicknamed the Gentle Giant because he's very tall, handsome, muscular guy. He'd been a high school athlete in multiple sports. Raised Catholic, family of four brothers on the south side of Chicago.
A White Sox fan, I hope.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Like him already.
And he was kind of the strong, silent type who just, you know, as I write about in the book, he just basked in the glow that Nancy cast. She was this chatty, arty, girly, you know, person who loved to cook and shop, and they fit together like two pieces of a puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Did they have any children before? I guess you said that this was their first child.
Yeah, no, this would have been their first. Nancy, they got married when Nancy was 23 years old, which to me seems very young, and she started out right away trying to get pregnant. So when she did, finally at age 25, she was just elated.
You led right into them going home from dinner, and then someone was waiting for them. And in reading your book, which I loved, it's a very quick read in the sense you don't want to put it down. It was very, very, very well written. But the event starts off with you not knowing what happened. Tell us about that.
Right. You know, I had gone home that Saturday night, and I had expected to see them, you know, possibly the next day in the afternoon after church. They went to church in the suburbs, and I went to church at this big downtown church called Fourth Presbyterian. It's right on mm-hmm. the Gold Coast, and I sang in the choir.
Mm.
And I was standing in the back of that church, you know, with my choir robe on and my folder full of music and the palm branch in my hand, ready to process down the aisle, when the church secretary came to me and said, "You have a phone call."
And?
And I was startled because who in the world would be calling me at church? And I asked her to take a message. And she said, no, you need to come with me. And my heart started to pound because I knew something was wrong, very wrong. And the first thought in my head was that something had happened to my father, a heart attack maybe. And so when I got to the office, I picked up the receiver that was, you know, off the hook, and the secretary said, sit down. And I said, no, no, I'm really okay. And she said, sit down. And then I knew something was very awfully wrong. And so when I picked up the phone and said hello, and I heard my father's voice on the other end of the line, my mind was reeling. I couldn't imagine what it could be. And the first words out of his mouth were, Nancy and Richard have been killed.
All right, now we're going to stop there for just a minute. We're going to take a break. We're talking to Gene Bishop, who is the author of a book called Change of Heart. And more than an author of this book, she is a person who has had a struggle with the concept of making peace and mercy and justice and her sister's killer. We'll be right back talking more about what happened after that. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Gene Bishop, who is the author of Change of Heart and a strong advocate for a concept we're going to be talking a lot more about, which is called restorative justice. This is John Smetanka. Gene, you sat there, your father said to you that your sister and brother-in-law were killed. What happened?
Well, at first I thought, you know, they're in their little Honda Civic and they're driving on the highway and a big truck smashes into them and drives them into an embankment. And so I said, what do you mean they've been killed? And he said, somebody killed them. And it was such a shocking notion that someone could deliberately kill my beautiful sister, who had everything to live for, who was such a good and happy person. I could barely take it in.
What happened then?
He told me to wait, that the minister of his church, Dr. Gil Bowen, would come and pick me up, and I was to stay there. And I sat there on the church secretary's couch for 45 minutes, just sobbing and just raging at God. You know, where were you when Nancy walked through the door? You know, and this killer is there, you know.
So he had told you that she was murdered in the home.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, it's kind of hard to believe that they allowed this, but the police actually allowed us to go to the townhouse where their bodies were and see them, even though it was a crime scene. And so I did go, and there she was in this body bag lying in a gurney. They unzipped the part so I could see her face.
You know, this is one of the things that so many people that I have dealt with over the years, and in family and friends who have had to go through tragedies, they sit and they ask the question, why, God, do you allow this to happen? Because, you know, they try to be good people. They try hard. We're all human. We all fail. But you at least have this hope that you've got a plan, that if you're close to God, everything's going to be okay. And then you get slapped upside the head.
Right.
And what did you get an answer to that?
I did. I wasn't so much mad at whoever had done it, because I get that people can choose to do evil. What I was mad about was, if you're all powerful, and I know Nancy must have been praying to you from the minute she saw a gun pointed at her and her husband, please help me, save my husband, save my baby. You know, that why was that prayer not answered, and where was God as she lay dying on that cold basement floor? And about a week after the murders, the police called my mother and told her a detail that we hadn't known until that moment. And that was that at the crime scene by her husband's body, Nancy, in her last moments, had drawn this message of love. She had drawn a heart shape and the letter U, love you, right before she died. And when my mother learned that, she burst into tears and said, "It's true, isn't it, that love is stronger than death?" And that told me that in Nancy's last moments, it wasn't all pain and terror and you know, the horror of the loss of her husband and baby and her own life in that moment, and that it was this transcendent moment of love. And what but the presence of God with her in that moment could explain that? And so I knew the answer then of where God was. God was right there on that basement floor with his arms around her, holding her in love as she's left this world.
Which still doesn't answer the question, why do people have those things happen to them when they're at a point in their lives when they are just starting, just blossoming, the world is she's pregnant, having their first child, this is what she's wanted. She's thought, I'm sure, as the pregnancy got started and she that, boy, this baby is going to be great because I'm going to do everything for this child and it's going to have a great future because I come from a family in which everybody is an achiever and we all go out and do good things in our lives for other people.
Right, exactly. Yeah, she had so many.
So where's the justice in that? Where is the justice in that, Jane?
You know, I think that we can't, you know, say that, you know, it's a matter of justice or injustice, that we live in a fallen world. We live in a world, you know, Jesus said to us, right, in this world you will have trouble. And it came to them. And when I, you know, struggled with the darkness of that, that just exactly what you're bringing up, I turned to the pastor of my church. He's retired, lives, has a home here in Three Oaks, Michigan, John Buchanan. And I told him about this horror story that I was struggling with, that this happy young couple and coming through their door and in the murky, you know, darkness, they see this shape. It's this person with a gun. And John said, you're holding onto this with both hands tightly. You're gripping it. And it's too much for you. It's too heavy for you to bear. You've got to open your hands, lift them up to God and say, take this, redeem this, do something with this. And that was the prayer I prayed from that beginning. And so powerfully did God answer that prayer.
Not a big flash, I take it. It didn't all happen at 1 minute, in 1 minute.
No.
In 1 second, one flash of light.
No, it was more, you know, I describe this in the book. There's this banner at my church when it's time for the children to leave the service and go off to their Sunday school classes. And the banner are these two strong hands of an adult reaching down and these two tiny hands of a child reaching up to take those hands. And that's what it felt like to me. I was just taking the hand of God and going step by step in the darkness through this dark valley, trying to come through, you know, the...
Yeah, like the 23rd Psalm.
Yeah, it is.
Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death,
right,
I will not fear because your rod and your staff have protected me.
Yeah, and you're with me. You're with me in this dark valley.
Mm-hmm. People, philosophers, theologians, people who have no interest in religion whatsoever throughout the millennia fight this issue of evil, the presence of evil and the existence of a God who theoretically is all-powerful, if not all-loving, all-knowing and whatnot. And this is a pivotal point in so many people's lives. And so many people choose to be enveloped by the despair of it all.
Right. I mean, we've just witnessed in South Carolina a 21-year-old with a gun who went into a Bible study in a church to people who were kind to him, who welcomed him in, and shot them all to death. And the response of the governor of South Carolina is, we're going to give this young man the death penalty. In other words, vengeance, killing. The response to evil, vengeance and killing. And then we have the families of the victims on the very day of his bond hearing addressing him directly via camera saying, we forgive you. We are praying for your soul. Good will come out of this.
We're going to talk much more about this later on when we get to the steps that you had to go through. But at the time we're at in your story right now, there is darkness, i.e., you don't know who did it. You don't know why it was done. You're getting little bits and pieces that the crime scene officers are helping, are giving you dribs and drabs. And I've been in the criminal justice system both as a prosecutor and a defense attorney for 50 years, 40 years, 30, or whatever it is. I can't even keep track anymore. And I know the system is imperfect. It isn't aimed to help victims, nor is it aimed to help ease the problems necessarily of the perpetrators. It is what it is. And it tries to solve so many conflicting desires that are in the human community. And it's just a hard thing. We're going to talk some more about that. But so you got little bits and pieces. How long did this go on before you knew who was responsible?
For 6 long months, we had no idea who had done this. And they called in a whole team of not just the Winnetka police, but police from other suburbs. The FBI got involved, Interpol,
Let's stop there. As my listeners know, I dealt with the FBI for many years, and on their side, and helping to help them make cases at all different levels and all different parts of the world. Didn't quite work smoothly with you, did it, when the FBI got involved?
No, because in my opinion, what they were interested in was not solving the murder and arresting the murderer, but rather using it as a fishing expedition into my human rights activities.
What were they? Tell us about that.
I was going over to Northern Ireland, and this is in a very different time. Now, you have people like Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness at the highest levels of government and being invited to the White House. It wasn't like that in the late 1980s at all. There were, these diplot courts where you could be tried without a jury, reversal of the right to silence, detentions and arrests without a charge, being held incommunicado for up to 7 days. So these kind of human rights violations that in this post-Abu Ghraib world sound kind of not, as shocking as, they seemed then. But I was going over there as a legal observer. I was observing trials, I was coming back and writing and speaking about them, and I drew the attention of the FBI.
And?
And so when this little, town of Winnetka, Illinois experienced this murder, the FBI saw an opportunity to come in and say, we think that the murderers were Irish terrorists and they really wanted to kill you, Jean Bishop, and so now you need to tell us everyone that you know in Northern Ireland and then we'll find the murderer. And I thought it was preposterous. Absolutely, blatantly ridiculous, given the facts of the time. The IRA doesn't target Americans. It always claims responsibility, even for its mistakes. No terrorist act at that point had been committed on American soil. This is pre-9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very clear to me what was going on, and I said, I will not help you hijack this murder investigation and drag it away from Winnetka, Illinois.
Oh, I'm sure they appreciated that.
No, they were very unhappy, and so that led to me, experiencing, my apartment searched, my phone tapped, my email opened. Everyone who called me or had, any kind of association with me would get a visit at their office by FBI agents flashing badges. It was not a happy time. And partly, well, mostly not a happy time, because I pictured somewhere like in a bar in Chicago, some person seeing this on the news. Jean Bishop, a target of murder investigation, and laughing, thinking, I'm getting away with this. I killed this couple, and now the trail to me is growing cold.
One of the things that I, after many years in prosecution, I came to this is sort of a humorous thing, a conclusion that 3/4 of the murders and serious crimes would not be solved were it not for jealous boyfriends or girlfriends, drugs or alcohol, because people pop up with, they can't keep their mouths shut. They can't stop talking or bragging. And now we do videos of crimes. It is a show that they want to be a part of. and sometimes it took alcohol or drugs to loosen up their tongues and let their egos flow, but they let go.
Right, right.
And I can, so the person that you're talking about, you know, that you thought about when this 6 months of getting involved with being the subject yourself of at least a lead into who committed the murders, is very frustrating.
It was, and actually it's such a great point you're making, because it was bragging to a friend that caused the real killer to be arrested finally in October of 1990.
In 6 months down the line, right?
Yeah.
What happened?
This junior from New Trier High School in Winnetka walked into the Winnetka police station and said, "I know who did this." His was a friend of his, also a junior at New Trier, David Biro, who had bragged about killing them, showed him the gun that he'd used, the glass cutter he'd used to break into the townhouse, another pair of handcuffs of the kind that he used to put on my brother-in-law, this trophy notebook of press clippings he kept about it, a poem he'd written about killing them.
I noticed when you were trying, going through this narrative, there's a little tick, and I'm a trial lawyer, and I watch his little ticks on people's faces. There was a hesitation when you began, before you mentioned David Biro's name. That was hard for you to talk about him.
You know, it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because for decades after the murder, I refused to say his name. I had this idea that there's, you know, this fame of Timothy McVeigh or Jeffrey Dahmer or John Wayne Gacy, where we know their names and not the names of their victims. And so when I would speak about him, I would call him the murderer or the intruder or the killer. I would never call him by his name, because I wanted his name to die and Nancy and Richard's to live. And it wasn't until I had, you know, truly forgiven him and sought to reconcile with him that I started saying his name.
We're going to take a break here. We're talking to Jean Bishop, who is the author of Change of Heart. And it's a story that is... produces a lot of thought. It's a great book. It's a very quick read. It's well written, and it's going to cause you to do a lot of thinking. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Jean Bishop, who is the author of Change of Heart and has been describing the series of events that started with the death of her sister and brother-in-law and their unborn child in a murder in 1990. This is John Smetanka. Jean, when we broke, you were talking about how difficult it was for you to come to the point where you could say the words, David Biro. And
right.
As I say, I can see it in your face, even now. And this has been how many years ago? 25 years ago.
Yes.
So, what happened in this case? Did it go to trial? Was there a trial?
There was a trial. He decided that the best way to respond to being arrested for this crime is to try to blame it on someone else. So he was put on trial before a jury at the main criminal courts building in Chicago, 26th in California. And he took the stand and said that a friend of his had knocked on his door that night and handed this gun to him and said, "Here, keep this for me. I just shot two people with it." The story was preposterous. There was a mountain of evidence against him, including the bragging that he did to this friend who testified against him in detail. And the jury convicted him after 2 hours. And then later on, months later, when he was sentenced, he received the mandatory sentence that a juvenile could receive because he was 16 years old when he committed the crime. And if you commit a double homicide as a juvenile, you get a life without parole sentence, meaning you go into prison and you die there.
Mandatory.
Mandatory, mm-hmm. Right. He also got a discretionary life sentence for intentionally killing the unborn child because they had told him that Nancy was pregnant, begged him not to kill her because that would harm the baby as well. And he still fired into her pregnant stomach twice to kill her. So as he's being led out of the courtroom, my mother was sitting next to me. And she turned to me and said, "We'll never have to see him again." And I was glad of that, even though I had forgiven him in my own mind and heart.
Why? Why?
For me, not for him. I mean, he didn't ask for it. He didn't deserve it. It was for God, first of all, because God says I have to forgive, right? Because I've been forgiven. It was for Nancy, because I don't think she would have wanted her memorial to be hatred and vengeance and bitterness. I think I had this idea that the best way to honor her is to do everything I could to prevent violence, to work against handguns, to work against the death penalty, anything that is, you know, about the deliberate taking of a human life. That was what I wanted to do in her honor. But it was also for me. I quote this in the book, and I don't even know where it comes from. But the saying is that hating another person is like drinking poison and expecting that other person to die. And I knew that hating him wouldn't affect him at all. It wouldn't bother him a bit, but it would eat me alive.
A client of mine who was in prison for 14 years for a crime he didn't commit, and we got him out because we showed who did it, and was done without DNA. When he was finally released, after a period of time, we allowed him the ability to the time to talk to a couple of reporters about his experience. And I say allowed him because it was hard for him after 14 years to know what life outside the walls were. Didn't know what cell phones were for. Didn't know how to use them. Hadn't had a meal at a restaurant where he had choices in 14 years. And he came to a point when he was asked, after the interview was over, one of the reporters said to him, "Larry, after all this, are you bitter?" And Larry, who is not a sophisticated person, he was not a college graduate, he was a truck driver who had had no prior record after being arrested for a crime he didn't commit, looked out the window and kind of just said, "You know, no." And the reporter said, "Well, why? It was 14 years for a crime you didn't commit." He said, "I decided some time ago that if I allowed myself to be bitter, I'd ruin the rest of my life. And all I want is a chance to spend some time that's left to me without bitterness."
Wow.
So you use the word bitterness. It's something that your experience, not just in this particular case, but frankly, you know, what you haven't talked about is your work as a assistant public defender. I know that from my experience, both as a defender now and as a prosecutor for 25 years, bitterness reeks in so many cases and so many situations, and there's nothing you can do about it. Everybody around you that you deal with. And I've seen too many people, lawyers, defenders, prosecutors, who become bitter.
Right. Yeah, I write about that in the book. I encountered this one woman who had a brother and sister-in-law who were brutally murdered, you know, beaten to death and stabbed with baseball bats. The wife, you know, raped repeatedly before she was bludgeoned to death. And, you know, she said, I can't say the Lord's Prayer anymore because it has the part about forgiving, you know, us as we forgive others, and I will never, ever forgive these animals that killed my family members. Bitterness, inability to say the prayer of her childhood, anger. She said she woke up every day wondering why the killers were still breathing, why they had not been executed yet. And I just shook my head and thought, what are the chances that they're waking up every day thinking about you, being consumed by thoughts of you? They probably don't even know you exist. Mm-hmm. And they have taken your brother and sister-in-law, and now they've taken the prayer of your childhood and taken your peace of mind. They have you prisoner.
Mm-hmm. So how did you take it? I mean, you say you forgave him. Did you attend the trial?
Every day. I was the only member of my family not on the witness list, so I was the only one that actually got to be there every day in court. And when he got that sentence, I was profoundly satisfied because even though I'd forgiven him, I write about this in the book, it was kind of a forgiveness like wiping him off my hands like dirt. Like, I forgive you, and now I'm leaving you in my dust. And it wasn't until years later when I met a law professor named Mark Osler, who teaches at University of St. Thomas. He is an ex-prosecutor, ex-U.S. attorney from Detroit. Gave me a book in which the author had written that if you've been wronged and call yourself a Christian, that it's your obligation to work to reconcile with those who've wronged you. And I remember at first feeling just affronted by this idea.
It's not something that people ordinarily walk into,
right?
That idea.
It is. It's very, countercultural, counterintuitive. And so I called Mark to yell at him about this. And he said, don't yell at me, call it the author, the person who wrote it. It was a colleague of his. He used to teach at Baylor Law School in Texas. And the author is Randall O'Brien, who's now the president of Carson Newman University in Tennessee. So I called Dr. O'Brien and told him the terrible, story that I've told you about the murders in my family and this thing he'd written. And I said, what would that even look like, reconciling with this person who's not sorry? And he said,
he wasn't sorry, by the way.
Right.
David Buhr was not sorry.
No, he never apologized to me or my family and never took responsibility. Didn't hear anything from him for decades. And so when I asked Randall O'Brien, what this would look like, he said it would look like Jesus on the cross. And I was stunned by that because I knew what he meant. On the cross, Jesus is praying for the people who are killing him. They are not sorry. They have not apologized. They're in the act of murdering him, and he's praying for them. And I had never, ever prayed for this young man who killed my sister. And that was wrong. And so I wrote to him. I said, I forgave you a long time ago in my own mind and heart. I told the whole world, everybody except you. And that was wrong. I've waited all these years for you to apologize to me. I'm going to go first. I'm sorry. And if you want me to come and see you, I will.
You said to him that you were sorry for not telling him that you forgave him.
Yeah, I reprint this letter entirely in my book. It's a short letter that I wrote to him one night, and I put it in the mailbox just saying a prayer that, God would do something with that. I mean, I didn't know if he'd laugh about it, throw it away, write back some manipulative, letter full of, lies. I mean, I had no idea that he would even respond.
So far, you're describing a person, and from what I've read in the book, you're talking about a person which, in one word in psychology, they use is sociopath. That is someone who had no conscience, who did it for whatever reason, but didn't bother him.
Yeah.
He didn't recognize the damage that he caused to other people. I've prosecuted cases in which I remember one defendant I prosecuted who was a teenager, killed someone simply because he had never killed anybody before, and killed a nurse in her bed, stabbed her multiple times, and cleaned himself up and went to school. And was he sorry? Three psychiatrists who examined him, one of them very liberal from the U of M, said the kid is a sociopath. It is a condition in which he has no conscience. It's happened since a primitive point of his development in life, and there's no chance of creating a real conscience in this person, no matter how long he lives, unless the only way you can stop him from killing again is to isolate him. Now, I'm putting that to you straight and hard because that is something that stuck with me. As I was reading this book, I was thinking of other people that I've prosecuted and think, I can forgive them, and they didn't harm me directly. They harmed my victims. But I'm not sure that I'm ready to have them come out.
Right.
But tell me about it, because this is really, this is a very important part of your story.
It is. And it's interesting because I was having a conversation with that ex-prosecutor I was telling you about, Mark Osler. And when I, was having this change of heart about, juvenile life sentences and, this young man, I was talking it over with him and said, I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, he's still remorseless. And Mark said, how do you know that?
Yeah.
He says, you don't know that. You've never even spoken to him. And that's why I realized I needed to write to him. And the letter I received back from this young man was that he developed, great remorse a long time ago, but hesitated to reach out to me or my family for fear that it would traumatize us further, that just an unbidden, unwanted letter from him saying, I'm sorry, you know, would have been something we wouldn't have wanted. And so when I finally had reached out to him, he wrote back, you know, as soon as he could, to say in this 15-page letter, you know, this is why I denied the crime initially. It was wrong. I was guilty. I did kill your family members. If I could take it back, I would. And then explains how he developed empathy over the years of realizing that as he's looking on television, for instance, and seeing news reports of some horrific murder and thinking, ugh, that person's, you know, a horrible person who did that. And he thought, wait, that's me. I did that. And then, you know, having empathy for us of wanting to know why and realizing that, you know, he never had told us that. And so he met with me. He put me on his visitors list. I went to see him, and he was very brave, I think, in confessing in his own hand to something he denied and in telling me the truth about everything he did, even when it made him look bad.
And you were brave in a different way, because you're going into a control situation. There was nothing he could do to hurt you physically. There's probably nothing he could do to hurt you more psychologically than he had already done. He was confessing, so you got some benefit out of that. But dealing with your own insides has got to have been the hard part in your movement to the point of going beyond forgiveness to talking to the man.
Right, because it was such a neat and easy thing for me before, right?
Mm-hmm.
To have this nice, tidy wall built between us of,
that's
like,
right,
me, good victim's family member, and you are the evil murderer, and so therefore I don't need to have any contact with you. But to see him as a human being, to, you know, see the shadow that crosses his face when I tell him, for instance, the impact that this had on my father, who found their bodies, you know, my mother, who was mourning the loss of her baby, her youngest
mm-hmm.
child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the best victim impact statement that anyone could hope for.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Jean Bishop, the author of Change of Heart, and a story that is hard to read in a way, but it's very, very interesting, and it's not just for me as a former prosecutor and a defense attorney, but rather as a human being. So we'll be right back. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect. We're now back on With Respect with Jean Bishop, who is the author of Change of Heart, a book which has just come out recently and is available, I'm sure, in Amazon and whatever the other and stores and everywhere, I suppose. This is John Smetanka. Jean, this process that you went through with David Biro, who mentioned his name, was not just a one-shot deal. You had series of contacts with him.
Right. I'm visiting him still. I've probably been to see him, you know, more than a dozen times since I started visiting him.
Has the psychological impact on yourself changed with the time that you have visited him?
Oh, it's every time there's some new epiphany or some, you know, blessing. I mean, on a visit recently, he said, you know, the more I get to know you and get to know your family through you, the worse I feel about what I did.
You've been doing criminal defense for how long now?
I've been doing it for 25 years, ever since, you know, Nancy and Richard were killed. I left the big law firm within months of their murders.
And during that time, you have seen lots of people who are charged with crimes.
Yes.
I dare say that 95% of them did something, whether they were charged properly or searched properly or got an improper or proper confession or bad jury instructions, whatever it was, they did something.
You're right.
It was against the law.
Yeah, yeah. I would even say 97%.
Well, all right. And sometimes it works out that they plead to something. You've probably been involved in plea bargaining with state's attorney's offices in Cook County, right?
Right.
And I don't know what your thought about it was. At one point, I took the position we would abolish plea bargaining in my jurisdiction, which we didn't, because I found out the realities were that I couldn't. And also, I think the realities of tailoring the system to actually what happened when you finally find out what happened requires some flexibility. But all of that, and now you're going to talk to me about something called restorative justice, and I'm sitting here with my fingers crossed and holding back, like, you know, stay away from me. What is restorative justice?
Well, you know, it's so interesting because we don't have any kind of formal restorative justice programs in the state of Illinois. It's, you know, there are kind of programs here and there across the country, and you know, one of the chapters in my book is about, you know, what does that even mean? There's a debate even on what it means and who it's for. Some people think it means restoring the victim. It means making the victim whole as much as possible. So in other words, if it is a young man who's, you know, tagging graffiti on your garage, that the, you know, young man has to come and clean off the graffiti and paint your garage. Some people think restorative justice means, no, we're restoring the offender to society, to the community. We're finding a way to try to you know, bring them back as rehabilitated and remorseful and productive citizens. I'm doing this, you know, seat of the pants, you know, made up restorative justice one-on-one with David Biro. And what it is two ways. It is him, you know, answering the questions that have been very healing for me. And realizing the enormity of what he took, that's something that's meant a great deal to me. And the, you know, restorative part, I think, you know, for him is to have this opportunity to demonstrate and express how remorseful he is. The sentence he is serving is one that says, we will never, ever take a second look at you. No matter how much you follow the rules in prison and do everything you can to show that you get what you did, you get how terrible it was, you would never do that again. We're still saying, no, we're having this finality of the sentence. We're closing the prison door and we will never, ever open it up.
And that is wrong?
I think it is when you're talking about human beings. What I've learned from my own change of heart after so many years is that if my heart can change, why not his? Why not the hearts of the other 98 offenders that are serving this merciless juvenile life without parole sentence in my state of Illinois?
I've got to tell you that it is a troubling thing for me to think of a person who has demonstrated from an early age by horrendous crime that that they fit into this category, they seem to fit into a category where professional people who are interested in healing and curing psychological problems say that they are not going to ever change, and they will kill again if they are given the opportunity. Now, that, I'm putting it to you between your eyes,
yeah.
How do we deal with that?
Well, you know, and that's the problem with these mandatory juvenile life without parole sentences that these, you know, people like David Biro got, you know, which is we didn't have a psychologist evaluate him. We didn't have any kind of report on, you know, what is he? Is he a sociopath? Mm-hmm. We have no snapshot whatsoever. It was this cookie cutter, mandatory juvenile life without parole sentence that was given, you know, by a judge, you know, whose hands were tied, you know, who the legislature prescribed that.
I'm going to make it something very clear to both you and the listeners. I think I've said this to other people on other shows. I'm opposed to the death penalty. I have been for a long time. I am opposed to mandatory sentences, whether it's for juveniles or others, for reasons that are not necessarily related to your case, but rather I think that the judges who try these cases, who have the benefit of a pre-sentence investigation, if it's done properly, they should have discretion to deal with I know how we got them and why we got mandatory sentences because of the strange confluence of Ted Kennedy and Strom Thurmond, who came together with the concept of guidelines, mandatory guidelines for the federal courts, and it was spread around the country. Bad discretion used by judges from place to place, all different kinds of reasons. Liberals and conservatives came up with this. And we're now backing off of that. One of our former governors, Bill Milliken, who signed bills for mandatory sentencing, especially for drug offenses, has crusaded against them. How many people tell you this? How many governors say, I made a mistake, I was wrong in supporting this? So, having said that, okay, I'm opposed to it, but I am concerned that who are you or I to judge whether or not a person has had that change of heart? We can judge it about ourselves, but how do we judge it about that person who has hurt you so badly and your family, and at the same time you've had this healing experience, which is a healing experience that yes. you're going through here.
Yes.
For you, and maybe for him, but how do we know it's not, he's just a good con man?
Well, see, that's where, you know, so much about our system needs to change. You know, one thing is that, you know, he started out having the ability to at least express, you know, some kind of demonstration of rehabilitation by taking classes. That was taken away, not from him, from everybody. College classes, no more. Participating in a music program, that's taken away, no more. Had a little typewriter, typing, you know, like stories, something to do, something positive, that was taken away. What can he do besides what he has done? To say, I'm sorry. To say, I wish I could take this back. To follow the rules in prison. To lead a quiet life. To meet with me and, you know, do things to express his sorrow and regret. What else can he do? And that's where, you know, there's so much of, you know, at least in my jurisdiction, you know, what used to be a system that was supposed to have some element of rehabilitation has completely given up on that. It's just incapacitation. It's just retribution. That's all it is. And we have to change that. And it's not just for the offenders. It's for the victims, too.
We learned in law school, you and I, that there are four purposes of punishment in the criminal justice system. One is retribution. That is you got to pay for what you did. Number two is rehabilitation, isolation, and deterrence.
Right.
Isolation of people who are likely to hurt again, and deterrence to either that person or other people in like situations. All of those things fit together in some sort of a sentencing process that a judge is supposed to go through and weigh. And we both know that that doesn't necessarily happen in great, pure systems. Because we don't have a pure system. It's a human system.
Right.
It's not a computerized system. And it's a system that costs money. And we don't have the money. We don't take the money, to allocate the money to spend for these programs. Unfortunately, we're coming towards the end of our time. And we could talk on, and I'd like to invite you back to talk about this whole system and what your thoughts are on changing it. And maybe we'll do that again sometime if you like.
I'd love it.
Good. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And until next time, remember that our mantra is, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.